Coming to you from cities all over the world, produced in Aotearoa, New Zealand, this is the Places for Good podcast. We bring you the designers, planners, and placemakers who shape the shared spaces of tomorrow, from stories of the past to visions for the future. We talk pride of place wherever you are. I'm your host, Boopsie Moran.
Our guest today has embraced various professional capacities, including social architecture, urbanism, art, and design. He has a deep commitment to making social and environmental transformation possible through the creation of sustainable cities that can work towards overcoming marginalization and fragmentation. Today, he can be found urban designing together with his team at Urbanismo Vivo, working independently in urban planning, walkability, workshops, urban interventions, urban projects, and citizen participation for the private and public sector. Born and raised in Buenos Aires, Argentina, but joining us from Brussels, Belgium, please welcome Matias Lastra.
Thanks, Boopsie. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's just start off with some of your projects that your team has undergone lately. What would you like to start with?
I think we could talk about Enlace Defensa. I think it's a very interesting project about an urban intervention in a degraded area in the center of Buenos Aires, in a neighborhood called San Telmo. And it's a very interesting case because it was mainly a degraded space under a highway that was built during the 70s. It was part of an urban plan that was about creating and improving all the highway network system of the city. But at the same time, it was a very massive program that creates these kind of divisions between neighborhoods that had a very big impact and effect on the shape of the neighborhoods of the city, but also in the way that people have relational links with others within the city. So I guess, that as it's happening in many cities of the world, but especially in Buenos Aires, all these spaces under the highway are usually in bad conditions, they have not the best quality in terms of public space, in terms of cleaning, furniture, any kind of facilities that normal locals, neighbors actually could enjoy as a public space with good quality. So the main purpose of the project was to improve this space, but also to create this kind of link between these two sides of the neighborhood that were more mentally, but also kind of separated by this highway. I mean, not physically separated, but more like a way of perception as neighbors from one side of the motorway or the highway, they don't really cross to the other side because of the quality of the public space, for example.
And so it was like a barren space that had no life and was quite dark, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it was literally an urban barrier, but also, very dark with the, the concrete style of the highway without almost any light. So especially during the night, especially in this neighborhood called San Telmo, that was a place that many people avoid when they want to, for example, return to their places from a bar or from a restaurant, because this is a very vibrant neighborhood full of bars, full of this kind of bohemian style. That is the oldest neighborhood of the city, which is very important to highlight. It dated from 400 years ago. So you can find many, many historical places, many, many things and a story, small stories that actually shape the identity not only of the city but also of the country.
Mm-hmm. And so what
the
were
born of the tango.
So what were some of the stories that you incorporated into the design or the activation of this area? What were some of the key histories of the place?
Well, I would say especially things related to the identity of the neighborhood, because it's such a rich identity place and historical place that we did a very strong work in terms of getting all these insights from the local culture.
Was
we
there
did
one,
many, many inter-
Was there one great person that really had a story where you're like, yes, we must do this when we speak about the area? Or were there a couple of stories that you really popped out?
There were many, many different stories. Some of them were very, very hidden behind, like, yeah, underneath this, the surface of the normal story. But there are also many, many stories that actually neighbors rose up and they brought it to us as stories. Very interesting, like, for example, the one of the oldest of, maybe if it's not the first church of the city, is located like two blocks away from this place, from Defensa, this Defensa Street under the highway. And it also, there is like a very famous network of tunnels under the surface of the barrio. So like, that's also something that is not very discovered yet, but it's from the colonial stage of the city. So that's kind of like these very, very particular and very rich stories that actually shape the identity, but also the markets, the local markets. And there's like a big, big market every weekend. And especially they kind of like improve and refurbish old furniture, for example. So there is a whole local industry around these kind of markets.
So like a repair. So they would repair things.
Yeah.
Vintage.
Yeah, and especially also, all stuff. Yeah.
And what about the tango's role, the classic tango? Was that a big part of that area?
Yeah, tango is very important in San Telmo, as it is in the south of the city. La Boca, San Telmo are the, as I say, the oldest neighborhoods of the city, but it's also tango. I mean, nowadays it's still been important, maybe less than it was in the past, but I mean, it's part of the identity, the culture, and you can see it everywhere. You can see it everywhere. It's not only the tango, for example, there are like some graphic devices or graphic styles related to tango, which is also interesting, like something called fileteado, which is a kind of like an artistic style with very thin and curved lines, which is very, very interesting. And it's also a huge part of the identity of the neighborhood. You can see signs, letters, transit signs, also like the, for example, yeah, advertisement of local shops using this style, this font, for example. And that's only there in the south of the city. And also that style is very linked to tango, for example.
So it's a very unique space that already has its own kind of story existing. So how did you incorporate that into your project? And then do you by any chance know how you were approached to start that work there? Was it the municipality that said, we'd like to bring life to this area, or was it the neighborhood first? What was the order of activation and why were you there, or why were you brought to that particular spot of Buenos Aires?
Yeah, I think it's very important to consider this, all these stories, aspects of the history, visual, artistic, like styles that kind of like shape the identity in order to create this sense and to rebuild this kind of like historical social patrimony of the area. So it is not only about the architecture, which is also very interesting in the, in that part of the city, because it's from the colonial for the colonial era, but it's also this kind of like social constructions of the culture and the normal culture, and also that mixed with the current culture, because tango and fileteado are from the 20s, from the beginning of the century, and it are very related to migrants from Europe, but now there is also another culture that is coming up, and it's mixing it with this old culture. So that's also interesting. For us, it was kind of crucial in order to develop this project before start designing, to get all this information directly from the people living there, from the residents who have the knowledge, who know the neighborhood better than anyone. So for us, it was like this participatory process to kind of like get that information.
Before the process starts at all, though, was it someone was walking in the neighborhood and noticed, oh, this place needs some help, Let's Bring Urbanism Movivo, or was a local politician or someone noticing it and said, I wonder who I can hire to come here and help us?
So the beginning of the project is a project kind of created by the Cities Lab, which is a department of the IDB, which is the Inter-American Bank of Development, which is a multilateral agency that works in different countries of Latin America. And they have this kind of office oriented to, as a city lab, to prove different policies, methodologies, tools, as, for example, playmaking, participatory projects. So they do this kind of like test prototype projects in different cities of Latin America. They, together with the local government, launched this university contest in 2019. And it was for students to bring up ideas about how to improve not only that part under the highway, all the areas under the highway along a very, very kind of like wide area, large area. So that happened in 2019. Three projects got to the final. There was a winner team from Cordoba in Argentina. They have these kind of ideas, very, very interesting ideas about how to improve the whole area. And then the IDB and the Cities Lab and the government, the local government, decided to start prototyping in a very specific place that was Defensa, the street Defensa under the highway. And that's how they kind of call us and they say, okay, we need help to implement this project. We have these ideas from the contest, but we need to actually create a project specific site for this site, specific located in this site.
That's really amazing. So it is a huge collaborative process. And so you collect the stories, you learn about the church, you get the neighbors' stories in there. Now, is it still up? Is there still this finished product sitting in that area, or is it temporary?
It was temporary. It was, it was designed to last a couple of months to especially test, to see if this intervention that was a very low cost, very quick intervention actually produced a change in the, we say, variables of the urban quality of the space. And it did. Well, I can tell you about that later. Yeah.
Let's just go straight to that. I'd like to know how, what's your metric? Like, how do you measure success? And tell me about that.
I mean, I have to give me 1 second because I have the statistics here. Somewhere. Yeah. And I have the numbers somewhere here.
Well, it's funny because I say, for Places for Good, we say success measured in smiles. So to me, just a video of everyone dancing and happy or a video of an unactive place shows that. But it is good when you're working with such a huge project that encapsulate all of Latin America and is meant to improve different areas within the continent. It is nice to have those numbers. So it's amazing that you collected the data. And while then the question is, what was your metric? So did you count people on the street? Did you count, what were your measurements for monitoring?
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple of different variables that we measure. I think this is crucial. I mean, what we're talking here is kind of like the most important thing in terms of like the political approach to these kind of projects. Like, we need data to support our argument. We need data to convince politicians that this is going to change the neighborhood for better. So yeah, for us, it's the most important thing is qualitative data, but also quantitative data is what we need to show that this kind of intervention, this kind of project is actually making a change. And we mainly measure the amount of people, the speed of the cars passing through the area, because we wanted to improve the walkability and the sense of a human scale of the street. So to reduce the speed of the cars was kind of like a key point in order to empower this kind of sense of safeness. When the cars go slower, you feel better than when you have the car passing very fast. We also measure the different, for example, activities that people were doing. We also measure graffitis, for example, as a sign of degradation of the public space. Mm-hmm. And we also did some surveys and interviews asking people more about their perception of the space in terms of cleanliness, safety, quality of the public space, quality of the public equipment, called furniture, or however you want to call it. So many, many different aspects in order to create this kind of like result, not only about the amount of people, but also about perception, which I think is very important. I have the results somewhere here. Yeah.
So did it start off with not many people walking around, and then what were some of the activations? Did you add seating? Did you make parklets? Did you bring live music? And if so, did you also use some of the locals, or was it a different way?
Well, there were like a couple of different interventions. Some of them were physical and some of them were digital. I mean, it's important to remark that we did this project during the 2020, in the middle of the pandemic. And this project is supposed to have like a very long participatory process in person, physically, from March last year. And that was impossible because of the COVID-19 crisis. So we had to shift that process into a digital one, which is, it was very, very interesting, because we had like 7-8 community meetings with neighbors and with different social actors of the area online. And as the pandemic started to, we say, like the situation, the sanitary situation started to get better, we had some kind of mix, physically hybrid meetings. But yeah, the most part of the process was online. And that was very, very interesting. And we had these kind of workshops with neighbors where we talk about identity, the problems of the neighborhood. We did this collective walk online using Google Street View. And we discovered things from the neighborhood, just listening to the residents. And that's one of the most important things, I guess, to create this kind of diagnostic of the area. And that was before starting the process of design. But we also had this kind of like co-design workshops that to create solutions together. And we try to put the people think about which kind of spaces they want in this street. Do they need furniture? What kind of activities do you imagine that you can have in that area? So it was kind of like transferring these tools or this power of design to residents in order to create like a collective proposal, and then to validate that proposal with more neighbors. That was kind of like the...
So yeah, so the like word of mouth. So it's spreading the... And because you start from the beginning and they're designing it together and it's participatory, it means that when they get the letter in the mailbox or they get told by a friend, they actually already know, because you've reached so many neighbors and that's one of your priorities early on.
Yeah, that's what usually will happen. Not last year, because remember that we were all isolated. So the kind of the power of the spreading of the world was reduced, because most of the people in the neighborhood, and it's a neighborhood, it's important to also say that it's a neighborhood with a very, very huge amount of old people, and elderly population in the neighborhood. So that was also a key factor in terms of the process and the participatory design. But yeah, I mean, we couldn't do that. And we kind of rely on connecting to important social actors of the area. And not only individuals, but also organizations, for example, cultural organizations or the shop organization, like, or the people from the market, these kind of things that they have representatives, that they actually represent more people of the neighborhood. And that was kind of like very important for us to find these organizations and these people and to interview them.
And were there any organizations that were really excited and super helpful and were a big part of it specifically?
Yeah, we had some. Yeah. And at the same time, we also had like some of them that were against, which was interesting, especially because this project was, was made a lot, the whole process with the local government. And this kind of creates some tensions, especially when you have like actors or organizations that are, have like a political stand against the local or the current government. So that happened. And we have especially many individuals, residents, very, very involved along the whole process, along the whole year, like around 20, 25 residents, people very into culture, people very into community organization, that they were very, very involved for the whole process. And they wrote stories about the neighborhood. I mean, I was mentioning to you that the intervention was not only physical. In terms of the physical intervention, we occupy one of the lanes, the car lanes of the street, and we convert that lane into a walking area. So we took out all the car park spaces. We used that space in order to kind of like, increase the surface of the walking surface or the public space, and also to kind of like increase the sidewalk, because the sidewalks of the street were very narrow. So it was actually not very comfortable to walk or to pass through that street. So that was kind of like, increasing the area to create this kind of like linear park. It's not a park, but it's more like a passage.
An extended path. Yeah, just a widened footpath. And did the people who were against the project, did they come on board once they saw how much more the area was improved? Or if they stayed angry and were angry, what was, do you know the reasoning of why they were against it specifically?
I think the reason is also valid and is fair. It's about how the government use its budget, what's our priorities, especially during a pandemic year. And I think like in our opinion as organization, public space became crucial last year. It was the only space where we were able to share. The power of public space last year was crucial. And with this project, we actually tried to create a good quality public space in a neighborhood that there is a huge lack of public space. So there is no space for kids to play. There is no space for sitting. There is no trees. There is no, this is a very gray area of the city, and all the big parks are quite far away. So it was very important to create that. But I know that many people, many organizations were against the project because of that, because of, okay, are you going to spend money in this that is temporary while there is this huge health crisis? But I mean, in fact, it's more like a discourse, because if you compare numbers, I mean, the cost of this intervention is really small. It's not nothing compared to the budget of a hospital, or nothing compared to like a huge policy program. You know, this is our interventions that actually are made to test the viability of further permanent interventions. And I think that's kind of like the hardest part to understand for many people and many organizations.
And if this is your during pandemic tactile urbanism project, do you have any projects in the last few years that were not during COVID or that were also using a participatory lens?
Yes, we usually support like all kind of participatory processes, not only for urban interventions projects, but also for cultural festivals or for projects that are kind of like led by neighbors. For example, the case of Plaza Clemente, Plaza Mafalda, where we were kind of bringing tools, transferring tools to neighbors in order to create a proposal to the government to, for example, rebuild this space. It was a space also in the city of Buenos Aires that
the government promised to build a public space, a park there, and they ended up selling the plot to a private developer that wanted to build a mall. And all the neighbors, all the people from the area got very upset, and they did some strikes, but they also organized themselves, and the Urbanismo Vivo was working with them, kind of providing tools, not only for the organization of the people, but also to create a co-design proposal to deliver to the city and say, hey, we want this. I mean, this is our identity, this is what we want. We are the neighbors of the area. We have the right to say what we want. I mean, this shouldn't be something top down. This should be bottom up. So we're here and we want this. And that happened. It was incredible. That's an incredible case that the government ended up building the park. Then we could discuss how participatory was that process. But at the end, the result was very positive because people against the construction of the mall got what they want. That was a public, good quality urban space. And that's kind of like a referential case
Did they have to repurchase the land back? Had they already sold the land, or had that not been sold yet?
I don't think so. I mean, they didn't kind of like literally sell it. It was more like a concession of the land. They probably canceled that. I don't know the legal details of the operation.
So an interesting factoid for Places for Good is we got started because a local park, piece of land that was earmarked to be a park in 2006, was currently a liquor store and was going to be sold as well. So we collaborated in a very similar story, not as big as a site, but I think that's a lot of the placemaking work is gathering people so that they're clearer when they speak to politicians. So with that project, and I guess with this, did you find the data from the underpass, or were you unable to find those numbers for the data that showed lower cars, less cars for the project?
Yeah, I did. I have it here. Yeah.
Okay, let's go. So what does success look like? So you've got the government's permission and you're there. And before, I need the pre-data though. So do you have the pre-numbers and the post?
See, you usually take the data like before the intervention, during the intervention, and after the intervention. And it was also important that we create the variables that we wanted to measure together with government, with the anthropology department of the city, which they're specialists doing this, and they also like actually collected the data. So that was also interesting, like kind of working together with government. But yeah, I mean, it was a very long process to define which factor, which aspects we wanted to measure. But mainly, I think the amount of people walking, that was kind of like one of the good references to see if the quality of the space improved or not. Especially during the weekends, there was like a race of 23%. So there were like 23% more people walking during the weekend, which is good, especially in the afternoon, in the morning. But in the afternoon, there was a rise of 37% during the afternoon, which is also really, really good. And also talking about perception, positive perception of the public space rose up from 36, that was quite low, to 70. So 70 of the interview people thought that there was like a positive perception of this public space. So there was this general perception, with very good numbers, that the place has improved. And also especially, you know, we were discussing about this, not only about numbers, but also about the kind of like this idea of creating networks, gathering all the people together. And I think that's kind of like the value of these methodologies, right? In this case, particularly, all the owners of the shops that were in this street were very involved. We worked closely with them for almost a year because it was very important for them, especially in a pandemic year where they were doing really bad in terms of economic performance. But we also think that commerce and shops have an important role in the public space life. And so we got along with them very well, and they were also part of the designing team to in order to understand where the furniture should be placed, where which kind of areas should we have, which kind of public space we want to build. And that was interesting because they didn't know each other, like the owners, for example, of the shops. They didn't know each other. And I would say that this project was very good to put all that together to create this sense of network. And I think what should happen after all these kind of interventions is that they already have a WhatsApp group or a communication channel or something that creates this kind of like communication platform where they can decide and where they can propose and get everything together in order to elevate or to take these kind of petitions to the government. So it's not the same when one single person asks the government to do something than when you have 20 or 30 owners of shops or neighbors doing that.
So similar to that park story you had in the beginning, you're just providing the tools of how to be more organized in your messaging and how to make sure that it's as many people as possible sharing their point of view. And that, like, WhatsApp's a great example for that. And then another project that's really interesting that you have worked on is the Kintsugi project. How did that, do you know how that started as an idea, as a partnership?
So Kintsugi started like in the frame of the placemaking summit that was in 2017. And it was like a very short contest for, a contest for like three or four urban interventions in the frame, inside this kind of like frame of this summit or this Congress, however we want to call it. So it was an intervention in Mexico City, in a also abandoned passage halfway like in the center of the city, and it was about kind of a similar condition of urban space, like trying to using tools as placemaking, painting, putting some furniture and creating new spaces in order to bring people to live that space. It was a very, very interesting process, at least for us as a team, because we work together with a local team from Mexico and it's in another country, it's a different culture. And it was one of our first projects, and it has, I would say, a success in terms of, it was very visible in media, and it also, in the street, but it was very short term in intervention, a couple of months.
And was it a big deal how the Japanese concept was part of that?
For sure. The whole concept of Kintsugi is using, using the resources you have and show kind of like the breaks or the joints of the problems, to make that visible in order to make it more beautiful. So that's kind of like the concept of Kintsugi, and that's what really inspired us to develop that project. It's like, okay, we're gonna show this and we're not gonna cover the whole street with paint. I mean, we're just gonna do some very focused interventions, but we also are gonna understand that this exists for this reason, the shape, the aesthetics or whatever is like this, which is gonna add some stuff, and we wanna try to highlight the good things and try to convert the bad things in nice things, aspects of the street.
So incorporating these types of values, let's get to the trickiest question, which is, if you were mayor of, it can be either city, you could be in Belgium going, oh, if I was mayor, I would do this tomorrow. It could be in the city you're studying, or it could be in your hometown. There, if you had the power to change a policy or incorporate better practice, what would you do?
I think it's very important to create these community committees that could design the urban space of each neighborhood. So I will create this neighborhood committee in order to rethink and to recreate the urban space of each area. And I think this is very important, being a mayor, in terms of like transfer, not only the, you know, the knowledge of like setting a scene to create this kind of like political devices, but also transferring resources. That's kind of fundamental. Because we've seen many municipalities encouraging neighbors to be active and to get together. But at the end, if they don't transfer resources, if they don't transfer budget, neighbors, even if they're organized, they can't do anything. So that's like a real redistribution of budget in a very local, small scale. I think that's fundamental.
So when you do these processes, are you able to pay any of the neighbors per se? Like, because if they do a workshop for transportation in the Bay Area, they've started giving $50 for their time and a meal. Do people participating in your design processes, is there any remuneration? Are they paid at all for their time yet?
No. All the people involved in the process, they came because they wanted and because they feel that it's important to participate. But it's, of course, it's not the 100% of the residents. It's usually in a small percentage, and that's a shame, and that's something that we need to change, because we need to make people be more aware of urban issues and things that they actually transit and experience every day. But that's also part of educational in terms of urban space. We need more education in terms of city. We need to teach people things about the city, not only the history, but also about how the city works. And because it's something that people experience every day. You know, it's you every day have any kind of contact relation with an urban space, even if you're going to work or if you're going to a park or whatever. So it's the only and the most important common space we have. And we need to know about that. We need to know which legal tools we have. We need to know what are our rights to inhabit in that space and also to be part of the creation of these spaces. It's not something that magically comes up, you know, like it's part of a process.
Yeah, I think that's the interesting part, is sometimes the more you work in this space, you feel like it's written in a way where it's meant that you can't understand the language. So half our work is the interim facilitator is teaching even just some of the big words. Like, do you find yourself explaining some words, bureaucratic language do you have to ever translate, not English to Spanish, but the acronyms? We have a lot of acronyms. We use, like, you know, four letters is.
I know what you mean. I think the hardest barrier is related to law, in terms of the for example, yeah, the use of land, and the use of land is a field that is related to law in many aspects, and it's very hard to understand which competences are in the government, which ones are in the neighbors, who rules the kind of like different characteristic of the land, which kind of things we can build here, which kind of things we cannot. And so that's kind of like, I would say that there is a massive lack of knowledge in that aspect, even for me. I mean, I don't really understand like the local building code of my city, because it's hard to read. It's very hard to read it, and it's hard to understand the different zones, the different, you know, functions, uses of the space, because all this kind of like very specific language has been made in the municipality, in the planning department, of however you want to call it, and they wanted to make it difficult to not be able to create a discussion or debate around this. It's very specific.
Yes, the consent process is very specific, and the amount of paperwork blocking access for those people that are walking in front of certain areas at 10 times a day sometimes, if you're trying to, let's say, make a pocket park or a pedestrian plaza, the biggest barrier to access is that land use laws, which is Wasapichanga. Her background is law, which is helpful and makes you think when you make an interdisciplinary team, that's the benefit of it. If you're all planners or just all architects, it's good to have a mix when you're, I think, working in these spaces where you're trying to access open public spaces.
Yeah, definitely. Multidisciplinary teams, especially in urban space, urban studies, are crucial in terms of that. We need sociologists, we need social workers, we need lawyers. We also need architects for sure, urbanists. But yeah, this kind of mix between the social sciences, the technical aspects, and the regulatory aspects also of the use of land are very important. And they all have to be part of the same boat in terms of trying to achieve a common idea or a common goal, that is to create better spaces, but not only better, more equal, more accessible, and spaces that actually represent the desires of the residents. And I think that's kind of like a key in order to change the way that all the plan or most of the planning department has been working in the recent years, especially in Latin America, where we have very top-down structures in terms of planning, not only for public space, but also for residential areas, industrials, commerce. So it's very important to get used to have more debates in this field. I mean, and that's something that politicians have to get used, because yeah, we have more knowledge and the knowledge spreads around the people very fast, and that's what we're doing, and that's the idea. If residents have more knowledge about specific information of the city, they will be willing to generate debates, and that's actually what we need to kind of like cut off and stop this very, very top down, or I would call it like helicopter view design of the city, you know.
I like that. It's like helicopter parenting, kind of not letting the people do what they know is good for themselves, and giving them a chance to test and trial these processes. And I think in your work, do you have anyone in government yet throughout Latin America, all the projects? Has there been any standout person that's really pushing against that within government that you've come across?
Well, I think we are like in the transition now, and that's very interesting. And I know this transition already happened in other parts of the world, but we are in the transition, I would say, in Latin America in general, where we are shifting from architects doing master plans to more like urbanists, sociologists, anthropologists, creating, you know, the public urban space atmosphere. So that transition is very interesting. At the same time, it's challenging. But I see, and maybe I'm being too positive, I'm seeing like a kind of a willingness mainly in the big cities, I would say. Like if you go to the countryside, it's a little bit harder to kind of like implement this new perspective of planning. And I think, we usually had to face problems or these kind of like barriers with professionals of the planning departments in the countryside more than in the cities. But I know that this process is in different stages in Latin America too. So some countries are going forward, some countries are not. Mm. And some countries also are taking these kind of placemaking methodologies as something very kind of a marketing oriented and as a very fast solution to get like a political, you know, like benefit from that, which is also risky. And we can talk about that, but that's kind of like important.
Yeah, when you use it too quickly and you use it more for branding rather than 1 year participant. It's a fine line, right? But I think it's good to hear that. I don't think you should feel bad for being too hopeful. And I think it's important when we're looking for those heroes, the fact that you don't have one standout and you see it as an overarching theme of upward momentum for Latin America, that's a nice way to see it. Within your project specifically, though, has there been any one individual that really pushed it through? So let's say when you're doing the Kintsugi, was there one person who really got into it, who was just a neighbor who wanted to paint? Or was there, when you worked with all those storefronts in under the motorway, was there one restaurant that was like, I'll bring free food or I'll play music? Is there any of those characters, key players in your work?
Yeah, not only one, like many, many of them, especially in that project in Enlace Defensa. When we
a name? Like give me
yes.
one.
Like, yeah, Mandinga, Tattoo, for example, Empanadas Tattoo as well. There was also like a record shop in front of the intervention. When we finish the intervention, we kind of celebrate with this kind of like, you know, party on the street with neighbors, and each of them provides something. Maybe they some of them put some music on the street, some of them brought some food, and it was like a very, very nice collective event, just putting all the people together. But yeah, I think that's very important what you're saying. It's like, because we kind of like try to create that sense of belonging to the project. And I think the best way to create that is to involve the people, not only assisting to the workshops, but also doing stuff and being responsible for some actions. And that's kind of like a differential point in terms of how participation is. So we don't want like passive observers as participants. We want active people, active neighbors in the participation. And that's something more challenging and is sometimes uncomfortable for governments, because it's, people are actually raising their voice and they have more power. But that's what we pursue. I mean, we want that on the street.
You want ownership of their space, right? And so sometimes there's right of way on a sidewalk, let's say. And if the record store all of a sudden wants to have a DJ out one night, they should find a way for them to have that allowed again, right? And it's really tricky unless you trial that process to show that no one gets run over by a car, or it actually, the measurements show that it's a safer, more enjoyable space. And then are there any other, like, so when you're, so the sound, I could just hear the party under your motorway, the kind of buzzing of that end night. Was there any specific tastes, smells, or senses that were going on for you in Buenos Aires during that time, or ones that you miss living in Brussels now that bring you home?
Yes, many, but especially I think the way that people talk, the way that people communicate in Buenos Aires is very interesting. Like, we are very passionate and we are very kind of like blunt and straight in the way we speak. We really want to like show off and do stuff, and most of the people are very, you know, like fun. And I would say that, yeah, the accent, the Buenos Aires accent, maybe you haven't noticed that, yeah, maybe you have to be like a Spanish speaker, but the way we talk, the way our body talks as well, like our body language is kind of very, I don't know, very unique. I would say that that's something that I smell, that's something that I miss. But also regarding smells, mainly food. And what can I say about barbecues? You know, like that's kind of like the crucial thing.
Oh, asado.
Yeah, asado. You can smell that every day, everywhere.
I love that sense of how you speak, because I've been in lockdown for 3 years. We just announced we're opening our borders. And I too miss the way LA, California people speak with their whole body. And it's definitely a sense that I never thought of until hearing your example.
Yeah, I'm really seeing that, especially being abroad now, the way we speak, the way we communicate, the openness to create new relationships, friendship. I would say kind of like the human warmth in terms of like how sociable we are, how open we are to have new friends and to invite everyone. You know, we invite everyone, like even if I just meet you, like I invite you to my place. And that's a different,
Good placemakers.
Because good placemakers, people really like to show off and talk about things that we have no idea. That's kind of like, I don't know if that's good or bad. It's probably both. But like as Argentinians, I would say part of the idiosyncrasy is to just talk a lot. You know, like,
it's good because I have to repeat a project probably 10, 15 times to every neighbor, right? Hundreds of times. And if you're comfortable in your cultural background, it makes it easier a little bit. It's not so forced to have to speak a script. And then in your own, any real big parts, I noticed that your organization does these, just did these walking festival. Do you know about the walking festival? Anything happening with that? I just missed
it. The walking festival is kind of the core of the organization, and it's how the organization started. And it's been almost 10 years organizing the walking festival, Festival de Caminatas, that was at the beginning inspired by Jane Jacobs' walks. And that was also very, very interesting because we absorb all her perspective or her thoughts about the city. We feel very inspired by that ideology and by that way of seeing creating the city. But it's also getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Like this year, for example, is the first time that we got funding from the government, from some companies as well, through an state program that intend to empower cultural initiatives. And it's going on now. I mean, it started last Friday and it's gonna last 10 days. So for example, now, today, there's gonna be some walks in Buenos Aires, more than 50 walks around the city, thousands of people, which is very amazing. Like there were like hundreds of people already last weekend assisting to these walks. And it was the first time that we had the funding to hire artists or hire writers. And especially this year, the walking festival was oriented in literature. So we brought many writers, local writers, to kind of like talk about the stories that about the city, how to link existing books or existing stories with the city, because many of the literature are related to the city in some aspects, and are very famous writers, Argentinian writers, authors that writes about the city. So it's kind of like this walking festival is more oriented in literature, and it's not only about writers explaining parts of the city. It's also you can have your phone and some headphones, and you can do the walks on your own. So it's more like interactive. This is kind of like a hybrid between physical and digital. So the idea is to, you know, create this device, the electronic device, that you can use it as whenever you want. So that's kind of the idea of the festival this year, which is amazing, and it's going to happen, I hope, every year with this kind of funding.
Well, and with having the ability, similar to this podcast, to save it digitally, you're really able to create this resource that really models this participatory kind of process. And by having not just digital, but the in-person, means that if you miss it, it's an equitable issue. So that you have the equity of people who can't be there in person or are worried because of COVID, they don't go. But it also makes the project live on maybe for 6 months. So like some of the conferences this year, they've been able to record. And if you miss the conference, you can go back. So it's really nice to have these new platforms. And I really, the funding is a big deal, right? Because instead of you having to be the artist, the facilitator, and the organizer, and the planning expert, you get to just really empower people that maybe weren't part of this structure before. Have you found that with this, having this new funding?
Yeah, I mean, the funding was always kind of like the first barrier of this festival. I mean, we didn't organize it anyway every year, because the sense of the festival is that each walk is self-organized and like designed by the leader of that walk. So it's a very collective process. It's not that we have like a central, I would say, committee or coordinator that is designing everything. No, we just invite people to create their own walks. We just create kind of like the framework or the base of the objectives that we want and some topics that we want to talk about. Each of the leaders of the walks, they create their own activity. But at the same time, it's like very important, I would say, this the reason behind the festival, that is connecting people with the city, linking people with the history, and kind of like try to stop this alienation process that many people who lives in the city have. I mean, I include myself, that you forget about observing, you forget about looking at the details of the city, and also looking or at the things that you cannot see, like non-tangible stuff, like stories that are part of the social patrimony or the social heritage of the city, because that's also part of the perception and sensations that we have. It's not only about what we see when we are in the public space, it's also about the story of that public space, what happened there, what kind of tensions were there, what's the history, and that also shape our perception and our idea of how to use that space. So the idea of the festival is to kind of like share these stories and link the people with the city.
Yeah, and I bet when people go on these walks, they're never the same again, I find. When you do, we call them a come walk with me, and we alternate who the host is. But once, hopefully, some politicians go on these walks, or people that fund these open space projects, and now they notice the little cracks that they want to keep there, but also make a little prettier. So this has been a really interesting, all these projects sound really fun, and I wish I could fly over there immediately. But since we can't fly today, and maybe in April we're allowed to from New Zealand, April 2022, where can people learn more about your work?
Okay, yeah, people can visit our website, urbanismovivo.com.ar, from Argentina, and also in our social media, Instagram, LinkedIn, as this Urbanismo Vivo. Maybe you can write it down.
Yeah, I'll add it in the notes.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Having you here today has been really great. Thank you so much for sharing with us the importance of human-centered and participatory design.
It's a pleasure. Pleasure to be here. It's great what you're doing. Looking forward to have another conversation.
If you enjoyed today's podcast, please share with a friend, and let's continue to grow and seed new ways of playing and connecting in our own cities and across the world. Thank you for listening.